Thank you, Lynn. I'm kind of laughing. I wonder what these tortillas are in Canada. Whether they are they made of the same stuff? I know when I lived in Italy for a while, I went to I ended up going to a Chinese restaurant, as you do when you're tired of Italian food when you've been living there for a year. And the Chinese food was made with spaghetti noodles, and it just made me laugh. So I always think that in every different country you go to, they do things differently, and it's even like the smallest thing. It's so interesting. I love it. So I'm very interested in your tortillas. Maybe you can come back to us and what they were. So yeah, we're going to be looking at karma yoga today, this evening, which I'm really excited about. It's such a beautiful, beautiful way to live life, and it changes everything. So not to big it up too much, but yeah, we're gonna have a great discussion, hopefully. So to start with, yes, spaghetti at the Chinese restaurant instead of noodles, they use spaghetti. So to start with, we're actually going to start with something that would be called karma yoga, and we've done it the last couple of weeks too, and it's a yajna, a consecration. So with that in mind, we're just going to settle into where we are. Just relaxing, I don't know, whatever we feel is tense, whether it's the face or the spine or the legs, the arms, the shoulders. And just closing the eyes and beginning to move within so that we can really just let go of the mind chatter and begin to come from the heart. So we're really offering our heart in this consecration rather than it just being something rote that we do at the beginning of our time together. So really just seeing if we can move in with perhaps turning our minds to the breath, becoming aware of the breath moving in and out of the nostrils or the belly, wherever you feel it. And then taking that awareness away from the breath and sending it down or up into the heart center, so just sort of the center of the chest, the Anahata chakra. And letting our awareness settle there into this spaciousness. And then making an internal offering with whatever words you feel comfortable with. Just sort of offering to share this time that we spend together this evening. To be for the benefit of all beings. May all beings be happy. May all beings be at peace. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace, peace. And then we'll just take a deep inhale together and exhale, opening the eyes. So I thought I'd just start by, because we're going to talk about what is karma yoga. Maybe it'd be helpful just to talk about what is yoga. Just to check we're all on the same page, because obviously in the West, you know, a lot of us, when we think about yoga, it's a physical practice. And many of us may be aware that yoga means union or yoking, but perhaps we don't really understand what that means. So yoga and a path of yoga is really a path towards self-realization. So when we say yoga and we mean union, we mean discovering our whole self. So not just the small self, the self that's our name and our labels working in the world, but what sits behind that. So the doer the witness, all of that, the path of yoga is to sort of reach that union, and it's called samadhi, and there are various levels to this enlightenment where you become fully realized, self-realized. And within the path of yoga, like many religions, there are many paths. So, several of them are talked about in the Bhagavad Gita. So there's karma yoga, which we're going to talk about today, and that is a path of action. So it's a path to union in action. And there's bhakti yoga, which would be a path to union, to self-realization through devotion, the yoga of devotion. There's Jnana Yoga, which is wisdom yoga. So it's a path towards self-realization through study and understanding. And there's Sankhya Yoga and Raja Yoga, many types of yoga. But for the Bhagavad Gita, Karma Yoga is really what it's selling. If we're selling something, it will be selling Karma Yoga, even though it's talking about the other yogas as well, and it will tell you how amazing they are and that they're the best. Generally, the Gita is seen as a book on Karma Yoga. And as I've talked about before, one reason for this was because at the time the Gita was written, or this is sort of, you know, what is believed, because no one's even really sure when the Gita is written. But it's believed that at the time the Gita was written, that Buddhism was taking hold in India. And the teachings of Buddhism often encourage people to lead a monastic life and leave their jobs and households and families and to reach oneness, this self-realization by sort of letting go of everyday life. And Karma Yoga really says, no, that's not what you need to do at all. So I always wonder if, you know, it was written as a kind of, as you could imagine, by Indian officials who were just thinking, oh my goodness, everyone's leaving their jobs. What's going to happen to our economy? Come on, let's talk about Karma Yoga. I'm sure it wasn't. But it's just, it really does sort of impress upon you that anyone can reach enlightenment and you can do it without having to go and live in a cave, that it's just fine, that your karma means that you are in this life, you know, an office worker or a train driver or a housewife or a mother, you can still reach enlightenment. So Karma Yoga really means the yoga of action. And I just wanted to read to you a couple. Lottery winner karma, yeah. That would be great. So a couple of verses from chapter 3, which is really where the Gita discusses Karma Yoga. And in sloka, it means verse 3, Krishna says, Arjuna, in the beginning I gave the world a twofold path, the way of wisdom, Jnana Yoga, and the way of selfless action, Karma Yoga. And then he goes on, in order to excel, mentally control the senses, let go of all attachments, engage the body in Karma Yoga, selfless service. And then in verse 9 he says, the world is bondage when actions are done just for your own sake. Therefore, Arjuna, make every action a sacrifice free of personal attachment. And we're going to talk about this sacrifice a little bit later. So what is this Karma Yoga? It's the action that you're doing, but in a selfless manner. And I think it gets really confusing, Karma Yoga, and I know that I was confused about it for a long time, and it kind of went like this, that I would hear people say, now I'm doing Karma Yoga, as if the day is sort of divided like a clock or a pie. And this portion of the day is my Karma Yoga. And that would generally mean, oh, I'm volunteering at the ashram. I'm going to sit at the front of the yoga class and collect the money for today for the teacher. Or perhaps I'm going to the shelter to help out. Or I'm collecting coats for winter for the homeless. And this was seen as, this is when I'm doing Karma Yoga. But actually, that's not it at all. So Karma Yoga, when it says yoga in action, means all of your actions are yoga. So it's such an interesting thing to think about. Really, when you break that down, what it's saying is all of your actions are the path towards self-realization. So it's living a life where every single action is a conscious movement towards self-realization. This isn't just your actions, this is every single thought that we have. So it's no good, for example, you know, Krishna says, you know, everything is action, even your thoughts. So if you go to a cave to meditate and you say, this is my, you know, path of yoga, But within that cave, you're thinking about your next meal, or you're thinking about a love interest you once had, or something valuable in your life to you that isn't self-realization, then you wouldn't be living out karma yoga. So it's in every single action, and that includes your thoughts. So, and I've mentioned this before, you know, my school of yoga is a tantric school. And one of the reasons I love them is because the tantrics see everything as a learning device to awaken. So they're very deeply into astrology, for example, which some people might say is, you know, ridiculous. What's the point? But they see it as, you know, what can I learn about myself that can lead me towards enlightenment? And they do that in every single thing, which is, you know, one of the things we most know about the tantrics is how they feel about sex, because Sting made that famous. But the tantrics take that approach to everything, that every single action can bring you towards enlightenment, which is why they also practice, for example, lucid dreaming. And so do the Buddhists. It's called dream yoga in Buddhism, so that even when you're sleeping, you are acting. And while you're acting as you're sleeping, you could be practicing towards enlightenment. So, for example, in lucid dreaming and in dream yoga for Buddhism, there are all sorts of things you can do when you become aware that you're dreaming, such as sit down and meditate, which apparently is like a minute meditation in a dream is like 12 years meditation in life. it's like double whammy when you do it in your dreams. I assume because you're doing it from an even deeper state of your subconscious. So really, when we talk about karma yoga as a yoga in action, we mean every single action, every single thought, all the time. It's not just every now and again when we're being giving. And we'll talk about selfless service as part of karma yoga a little bit later, and what really it means, selfless service. So as Krishna points out here, you know, he is acting in this life. There is no, Krishna himself is enlightened, but he is in action. Like, nothing can escape action. In the Gita, and we'll talk about that later, it just actually discusses the nature of things and why everything is always in action and how that came to be. So in verse 22, for example, in chapter 3, Krishna says, Arjuna, there's nothing in the three worlds, so nothing on this plane, nothing in the astral plane, nothing in the celestial plane that I ought to do, nor is there anything for me to achieve that I have not already achieved, and yet I continue doing things. Which is, you know, I mean, he's an enlightened being, so what does he have to do? And yet he is here, and all of Krishna's actions are not karma yoga because he doesn't have to become enlightened. So there's a bit of a nuance here. What is it that the actions of Krishna are? And it's actually a lesson for us. There are two ways. Well, I take that back. There are three ways of acting in the world according to the yogis. And the first is based on our desires, based on our samskaras, and based on cause and effect. So in yoga, and it talks about this in this chapter, the idea is that, you know, we go through, say we were entirely pure, we would be completely in our present moment and things would just happen to us and they would be let go and we would be moved to do things, a bit like the Tao. We'd just be moved through Dharma by you know, whether it's God or oneness view, whatever you want to say. You're just moved by nature, by all beings, by God, yeah, by the divine. Being moved, and that is sort of a very pure way of being. But then the yogis say what happens is we have senses. You know, in our human existence, we have these senses, and those senses drag us off course. So from the senses, we then start having desires. And not only desires, cravings, we also have aversions. And so when that happens, then we start acting from our from a place of these desires, of what we want and what we don't want. And they in turn will cause samskaras, which are imprints in our memories, and those will cause us to act in certain ways also. So the whole idea of acting in the world is kind of just sort of happening from the point of the small self. The mind is involved, and also the mind is involved in ways we don't even know. And I was thinking today about The Untethered Soul. I don't know if you have read that, but it's by Michael Singer. Michael Singer. And he gives this example that I think is really beautiful in The Untethered Soul of exactly what samskara is and how we act from our samskaras. And his example is that we're driving down the road and the trees are part, it's a beautiful day, and you know, we're taking it all in, the sky and the tree, but we're completely in the moment, and the tree comes, arises in our consciousness and passes through us. The tree arises and then passes through us. And then a blue Ford Mustang comes into view on the other side of the road, and we think, my girlfriend's got a blue Ford Mustang. And then as the car comes nearer, we notice that there are two people in the front seat, and they appear to be hugging each other while driving. And all of a sudden, the car passes us, and now that's all we can think about. So the trees are still passing by and the blue sky, but we are now blocked to experience any of that because all we can think about is our girlfriend is possibly driving her car with a gentleman next to her who she's hugging. And he says, you know, that, and that's the end of the story. And 5 years later, we have a new girlfriend and we're much more mature and we're driving along another country lane and really having a lovely, lovely time. When out of the corner of our eye, a blue Ford Mustang passes. And we don't know why, but all of a sudden we feel moody and grumpy. And we may turn to our wonderful new girlfriend and say something that's spiteful. And this is due to what he says would be a samskara, that at that moment in 5 years before, when we noticed that blue Ford Mustang, and it wasn't able just to process through us. It caused a block, and that block would have been something from an emotion, a desire, a craving, or an aversion. I mean, guessing that aversion would have been to our girlfriend seeing someone else. So what he's saying is that when we're, you know, we can be completely unaware of these samskaras. It could be that we just didn't even register that our mood changed because we saw a blue Ford Mustang, and 5 years ago we dated someone who was potentially cheating on us in their blue Ford Mustang. We don't have time to really compute that. So the action of being grumpy towards our new partner wouldn't even know why. So there is this sort of way of living in the world that wouldn't be karma yoga at all. This way of living in the world that most of us do, which is we are just driven by these cravings and aversions all the time. And really what we're saying is we're thinking about ourselves. We're thinking about us. We're thinking about, I want this and I want that, and this is me and this is right. And all that is obviously based on our experiences. And for the yogis, your past lives too, your past karma. And then everything we do that's acting out of that will have a cause and effect. So we could get stuck in this cycle of it. So this would be one way of living. And Krishna warns a lot through the Gita, and he's really telling Arjuna, particularly at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, this is don't get caught in that cycle. That's ignorance. You don't want to be there. And then there is the entirely opposite way of living. And I sort of call it Dharma Yoga. I don't think that's right. And this is really how Krishna is living right now. So as you know, as Krishna says, you know, if he's achieved everything that he needs to achieve, he has no desires. He's completely desireless. He's enlightened. He's done everything he needs to do. He's relived, you know, enough lives to work through all his samskaras. And yet here he comes back and he's doing things. He's obviously doing things. You know, for a start, he's stood in this chariot about to engage in this war and advise Arjuna, he is doing things. But what he's doing here is he's so pure that he's just moved. As I mentioned before, he's moved by the Dharma. He does whatever he's there to do. He doesn't think about it. He just lets himself be moved. And also what the Tao Te Ching says, or just let yourself be moved. It's beautiful. Like water, just letting yourself flow. There's this sort of pathway to get from, how do you get from this place where here we are just driven all the time by our desires and our busy, busy minds, and our, you know, this me, and acting from this place, to getting to a place where Krishna is, where you just completely are moved by something else. There is no I and there is no me. And that sort of the path in between is the practice of karma yoga. So getting from point one to point three would be karma yoga. So how do we do that? Let's take a sip of water. Right. So how do we get there indeed? So in verse 9, I'm just going to read that again. If the world is bondage when actions are done just for your own sake. So therefore, Arjuna, make every action a sacrifice, utterly free of personal attachment. And then he goes on, after creating humankind together with yajna, sacrifice, the Creator said, through sacrifice, you will increase yourself and get everything that you want. So there's something to just notice here. One is that Krishna is saying that humankind was created together with sacrifice. And he's really saying humans were created with free will. They were created with the potential to choose. And I was thinking about sacrifice and what it means, and so I looked up in the dictionary and I found this really sort of lovely definition that I felt sort of hit it on the head with what Krishna's saying here, hit the nail on the head. It says, sacrifice is an act of giving up something valued for the sake of something else regarded as more important or worthy. So I thought this was really interesting, because sometimes when we think of sacrifice, we think we are giving up something of value to get something of less value. But that's not it at all. Or the thing we're giving up is so valuable that we will lose in the sacrifice, that some sort of detriment will be made to us. But actually, sacrifice means, and I'll just read it again, an act of giving up something valued for the sake of something else regarded as more important or worthy. And this is really what karma yoga is, that when we give up acting from a place of me, we are actually opening ourselves up, or what we're really saying is there's something more important, there is something more worthy than me. And that is a very different way of thinking to how, you know, most of the world, and I can't speak for the world, I don't know the world, but I speak for myself, how I'm used to acting. It's really just thinking about all of my actions and thoughts, not for me, it's for something else. So again, I'll just read this verse 10. After creating humankind together with yajna, with the ability to sacrifice, the Creator said, through that sacrifice, you will increase yourself and get everything you want. So it's basically that the human experience, it's saying, is that you can get to choose to let go of that small self of the mind and then have everything you ever want. Which is very beautiful. And I was thinking about, you know, how the difference between humankind and then sort of plants, fruits, flowers, trees, and animals. And Swami Satchidananda here points out that we all go through this cycle. The plants are learning, When they learn something, they may evolve, or maybe they'll become animals and they'll learn something, and eventually they'll become humans, and they have to, then they get this free will and learn something. But I often think that, you know, of plants and flowers as being sort of very pure to the Dharma, that they, you know, they're just being moved. The water comes and they grow, and maybe, you know, there's a stone there that blocks their path, but they are just being moved by nature. So I think it's kind of interesting, this sort of, I don't know, this thought that we have the free will, as if we are, you know, more further ahead on our journey, when clearly, you know, we're not. We really want to be back to nature, where we're just letting ourselves be moved. So it's an interesting cycle that of incarnations that seem to happen, where you go from being just purely one with nature, and then coming through, and then being this human where you get to have a choice. And also, just worth pointing out, I mean, the Gita is very clear that humans are not above animals, and not above plants, and not above, and so it goes on, that we're all just one together. But interestingly, we have this quirk where we can have the free will and make a sacrifice of all of our actions. And as I mentioned, this is called yajna. Okay. So yeah, I wanted to mention something that happened this weekend. And I thought, like, this really represented what it would be like to sort of live with an idea of karma yoga, or even, you know, to live like Krishna, where you just let yourself be moved. So I went to birding. My first time I'd been birding. I love birds. But I actually went birding, where you go in a group and with your binoculars and try and spot birds. They're on their migratory path right now. So there's lots of birds to be seen. And I went with some Zen Buddhists. I don't know enough about Zen Buddhism, but this particular group of Zen Buddhists were very into the earth, and helping the earth through the this challenging period. Of climate change. So we arrived and the service started Right. Sorry about that. I seem to have lost connection. So I don't know where I was. If anyone was listening, so I guess I'll just continue where I was, and we'll see what happens on the recording. So so it was at this gathering, and it was offered that we would offer some service on this birding talk, on this birding walk. And so we chanted a mantra, and I believe it was a mantra that would invoke a compassionate Buddha. And so that we were really asking for compassion for all of the park that day and all of the birds that we saw. It was very beautiful. But the teacher, who was teaching, made this comment that really sort of spoke to me, and I thought about, you know, these ways that we have of acting in the world and what drives that. And she said that, you know, for us to sit and contemplate for a while, that we have this view of Earth, of planet, that we shared by, you know, 8 odd billion people. And we think of the Earth as being a certain way. You know, and we have scientists who are exploring Earth, and we write books about Earth, and we talk about Earth, and we feel like we really know Earth, and sometimes we'll even say we're the guardians of the Earth. And so we have this very rigid view of what the Earth is. And she said, now, you know, imagine what a bird's experience of Earth is, or a dolphin, or a tree. And you can begin to see that there are many Earths. And our view as humans of what Earth is just a view that we believe is so important because we're humans and we think we're so important. And yet, you know, if were we ever able to ask my dog or your cat or a bird, of which there are, you know, billions of animals and creatures out there, it would be something totally different. And so it really got me thinking about how incredibly selfish and self-obsessed or self-important we are as humans, that we, and this can only influence the way we act in the world, that we just think we are, you know, it's all about us. And really Karma Yoga is sort of helping us break that sort of disease that we have, really, this sort of narcissistic view we have. And, you know, just as an aside, the Zen teacher then went on to say, you know, when you think about yourself here on the earth, or when you're contemplating the earth, think about, you know, what would happen to the earth if the bees left. And you can imagine what that would look like for the earth. That would be pretty devastating. Or birds or the trees left, you know, that would be game over. And then you think about, what if you left the earth? What is the detriment to the earth then? Or what if humanity was no longer on the earth? What would be the detriment? And it wasn't really to depress us. It was more about getting in the mindset of, we're here to benefit Earth in some way. And this, I feel, is like the essence of Karma Yoga. It's trying to get us to act from a place of always benefiting others, always benefiting others, always coming from this place of, it's not about us. So that's sort of easy to say. So how do we put it into practice? So as the Gita says, make every action a sacrifice utterly free of personal attachment. So it's really, as I mentioned before, about sacrifice. That is what Karma Yoga really is. And it's not giving things up. That means just every single thing we do, we are not doing for ourselves. We're doing for something more important, more worthy. And that could be others. Or it could be, you know, driven by our desire to awaken, which it probably will be. And ultimately, even that desire will have to go. Because there is still a selfish desire that we want to awaken. So yajna can take on many forms, sacrifice. It could be in the actions that we do. But ultimately, yajna is really the intention that we bring into the things that we're doing. And this is sort of obvious, but, you know, if you see a homeless person and you care for them and you give them $5, that is very different to you're walking down the street with your friend who you want to impress, and so you give a homeless person $5. Now, it's very clear that the intention behind those two are very different. One's pure and caring and thinking about another, you know, especially if that $5 is what you needed for your lunch, rather than just doing it to impress somebody else. So it really is about the intention behind it all. Good evening, Caroline. It's lovely to have you here. So one is that the sort of just intention. So, you know, even everything you're doing throughout your day, you could be saying, I have, you know, this is with the intention of sharing, and obviously that's what we do at the beginning when we're together. It's to keep us, help us get in that mindset. So a lot of my yogi friends will offer a yajna consecration throughout the day, and they'll pick like generally events that happen a lot. So every meal they sit down for, they'll offer a consecration or yajna to begin with. And again, as I mentioned at the beginning, it's not just doing it rote. It's not just saying, oh, thank you for this meal. I offer the karmic fruits of this meal to everyone. It's really connecting with your heart and thinking about, you know, who brought this meal to you, how lucky you are and to have this and others don't. And if you could only, I mean, it's not possible for you to share your bowl of rice and curry with the whole world. And so really you're just like setting this intention in your heart that you just hope they receive all the benefits and you just hope that everyone's happy and that you wish that. And it's a really beautiful way. So you could do it with every meal. You could do it with all the sort of things that they say that you do on a regular basis. I'm trying to think of other examples and sort of evading right now. But if you went and spent some money and treated yourself to something lovely, you could sort of go inside and say, oh, you know, I offer all this to someone else. And the other thing with yajna and this consecration and karma yoga is that when people offer you their thanks, that you offer that on. So I know that some of my teachers, well, you know, you could go up to them after a class or a lecture or something, and I'll say to them, no, thank you so much, it was such a beautiful class, and they'll look at me and just say, and thank you, Shiva. Like, it's automatically gone up. So their thanks is just offered up back to their awakening or back to the oneness of all. So there are so many beautiful things you can do to live this life of karma yoga without even having to do stuff. It's just really bringing this intention all the time of putting yourself lower than others. Seeing what else I've got room. And karma yoga, I think it's just really, it's so wonderful because it sort of encourages you to explore all the ways that you put yourself first. So I wanted to share with you, I'm really interested in moral psychology, and how humans approach morality. And I don't know if you've heard of, the trolley problems, but it's something I was studying this week, as part of a course I'm doing on human morality. And it's also about trolley problems. So you may have heard of them. The trolley problems are, something that, you know, psychologists will suggest to people and to try and gauge where human morals lie. So one of the trolley problems is there's a trolley and it's going down the track really fast and it's going to hit five workmen who are on the line, and you hold a switch, and if you flick that switch you'll divert the trolley down a different track and it will hit one workman. What do you do? Do you kill five or one? And you can flick the switch. And most people will say, okay, I'll flick the switch. And then the second trolley problem, the trolley is hurtling down the track, and you're actually now stood on a bridge above the track, next to a really fat gentleman, and that's relevant. And the train is hurtling towards what again is five workmen on the track, and they're all going to die. But if you push the very large man you're stood next to off of the bridge onto the track, he's so large he will stop the train. So what do you do? One person dies or five people die? But of course this one you're more engaged in. So obviously we're trying to work out your morals. And a lot of people will say, no, okay, I couldn't push the guy off the track, off of the bridge. And then in this other example, and this is relevant to karma yoga, you have, so pick whatever is valuable to you. So say you spent your retirement on a really cool car, or, you know, maybe it's all the donations that have been put together for the Awakening Together Church, or perhaps it's, you know, your country home that you're hoping to retire to that you've just spent years doing up. Whatever it is, if there's really, really a value to you, imagine that, and it's sat here, okay? And there's a trolley, yeah, because it's a trolley problem, and it's coming down the track, and it looks like it's going to hit a small child and kill them. Or you can divert the trolley to go directly into whatever it is that's beloved to you, the house, the church, the car, and destroy it. So faced with destroying something really of value to the love or saving a child's life, most people will say, I would save the child's life and let the trolley go and destroy this thing that I love. But what Peter Singer was the psychologist who talked about this, this was back in 1999, he said, but look at it this way. The average cost back then to save a child in a developing country was $200. So think of all the times that you've spent $200 on a nice meal out, or maybe an outfit, or imagine how much you spend on a Mac computer. And then think how many children's lives you could have saved. And it becomes sort of a really interesting sort of question for yourself to start looking at. It's a bit of a shock when you start thinking, you know, this is true. You know, I could send that money instead to a child in need and save a life, but instead I'm going to spend it on this. And then we'll notice all the things that come up for us then. Perhaps the mind starts to say, oh, well, you know, but, you know, what if it doesn't get to them? And some charities don't, they take a high percentage, and really, you know, this is all theoretical. It probably isn't going to happen. And if I knew a child, I could probably. And we start to find all these excuses. Oh, Lynn has added, but the workers who are involved in making the computers need to feed their children too. So this is great. So this is really like what these trolley problems start to get us thinking about. For me, it's similar to karma yoga in that it starts to get us thinking about when do we put ourselves as more important to others. As she says, a long chain of people depend on it. It's a moral argument, and we could argue about it for days, and I personally don't have an opinion on it, you know. But what I do love is that it puts us in this place of having to really think about the times when we choose us over others. Because if we were thinking, I'm buying my Apple computer to put food on the table for the people who make it, that's one thing. But if we're thinking, oh, I'm buying an Apple computer because it will make me rich, or I don't know, whatever, then that's another. And so this is just an interesting thing to think about. And I believe that karma yoga always sort of keeps you on your toes in your life, just being honest with yourself about, okay, well, you know what, I am spending this $200 on a coat I want because the coat's pretty. And yes, I know I could give this $200 to someone in need. And that's okay, because, you know, it's about non-judgment. You know, the Gita isn't telling you to judge yourself in any way. Exactly, Lynn. It's just like saying, just looking at your mind, as you say, looking at your mind when you're making decisions. And that really, for me, is like the essence of karma yoga, just always sort of turning inwards and looking at what you're thinking. And then ultimately, obviously, what we're hoping to get to is a state like Krishna's, where we don't even have to think about it, we're just moved by it. And so then it doesn't matter what we do, because we know that we're doing God's will, or the Dharma, or we're acting in line with everyone, or we're following the Tao, or however you want to say that. So I just think it's such a wonderful thing, karma yoga, to constantly be in this place, as I said, of thinking about what we're doing and our intentions behind it. And there's another story, and it's very colourful, so I wanted to share it with you. I know Lynn will have heard this before. Swami Sachidananda shares this lovely Indian story. And it's actually taken from the Mahabharata, where the Bhagavad Gita is part of. And let me just see if I can find the page, otherwise I could just... Oh, my neighbor's dog. I'll just tell you about it myself. Well, here it is. So the Pandavas, that's Arjuna's family, him and his brothers, and Yudhishthira's older brother, who's ultimately going to be on the throne when they win the battle. So there's the royal ceremony in the Mahabharata before, and I actually don't know if it's before or after the battle. But they have this big sacrificial yajna, and they have this big sacrifice, a religious sacrifice, and with much pomp and show, and done at a great expense, and they had so much food, and it was wonderful, and they invited lots of these people to come and share in it, so they could all enjoy it. And then during this meal, this mongoose comes in and starts rolling around in the remnants of the offered food and the flowers, because they were offering the food up to the gods. And when the mongoose stands up, he sort of shakes himself off and looks really disappointed. And Yudhishthira, Arjuna's older brother, stands up and says, "You know, hang on a minute, you're not an ordinary mongoose. We see half of your body is gold, and the other half is just ordinary mongoose. So how's that? How did that happen?" So the mongoose tells them the story, and he says, "You know, one day I was just an ordinary mongoose. I was roaming around, and I came to this small hut, and I sat outside, and I watched what was happening. And there was a poor teacher, his wife, his son and daughter-in-law living there. And there was a big famine at that time, and food was very scarce. And they didn't have anything to eat, but one of the gentleman's students had bought some flour to be cooked into a roti, just like a very simple bread. And the teacher's wife was preparing it, and it was almost ready. So the teacher, who was a very pious man, had, you know, this particular ritual, which many people do. This is almost like a yajna, a karma yoga. He goes out of his house, and he looks this way, and then he looks the other to see if anyone is there, because the scriptures say that you must treat anyone who comes along in the form of a guest as God. And so before a meal, it was sort of suitable to go out and see, is there anyone here I should be offering my food to? So and he's just got, you know, a couple of roti breads to share. But he sees someone coming. And so he stops. The gentleman's coming on the road, and the teacher says, "Oh, you know, would you like to have some food? We're just cooking a roti bread." And the gentleman says, "That would be lovely." So he comes in, and the wife has four rotis for every person. So the teacher gives his share to the guest, and the guest eats it. And then the wife says, "Could I offer you something, another one?" And he says, yes, I'm just so very hungry. And so she offers him her roti bread. And the son and daughter-in-law do this, and they offer him their share too. And he says, "You know what, I could still eat some more." So he eats it all, and then he says, "God bless you all," and off he goes. He walks out. And half an hour later, all four of them collapse and die because they're just so weak from this hunger. But the monk who says, "But I saw them die in a state of joy. I was watching everything, and I was so hungry myself. I went in to see if anything had dropped to the ground as they had made the rotis, and I saw some flour and crumbs, not even fit to eat. So I just went and rolled my body in it. And when I stood up, the half of my body that had rolled in it had become golden. And then I understood there is something mysterious, miraculous, and divine in their actions. Yes, they truly dedicated their lives for the sake of another. They performed a beautiful yajna." And then the mongoose goes on, "So I had this crazy idea that, you know, how will I ever get my other half, the other half of my body to be gold? So ever since that day," he says, "I've been traveling around and rolling everywhere. And I heard that Yudhishthira, this, you know, great Pandava, this wonderful king, was preparing a royal yajna. And so I thought, oof, this is really the time it's going to happen. I'm going to have the rest of me turn gold. So I came running all the way here. But now you see, I've rolled around in your food, and, well, I'm still not gold." And Swami Satchidananda, he says, "You should have seen Yudhishthira's face." which made me laugh. So it really is this sort of, you know, whole idea of, it's the intention behind everything that we do, is to have this sort of sense of it's the purity of our intention, I guess, is what I'm saying, that karma yoga really is. So one other thing I wanted to mention, because I really wanted in these sort of evening discussions to talk about how we can actually practice the teachings of the Gita. So obviously we've talked about yajna and the things we could do, like offering our daily routines up for the good of all. And then remembering that in yoga it's not about creating good karma, we're actually trying to get rid of all karma, come out net so we don't have to reincarnate. So we're not doing good things for merit, we're really just doing good things. We're not doing good things. We're letting ourselves sort of be moved for others. Really, that's what we're trying to do. So what would help us do that? Obviously trying to listen more, becoming more silent and still so we can hear a voice inside that tells us or guides us. And obviously asking in every moment, you know, how can I serve? How can I serve? Again, just so exploring some of those moral concepts that we have, just to see, you know, and being honest with ourselves, when do we put ourselves first? You know, if what would have to be on the track for us to not flip. And also one thing I thought was gratitude. I really feel that a karma yoga path is one of real gratitude, because when, you know, it's very hard if you to offer everything that we have, everything that happens in our lives. We have our own karma, different word. I mean, it's the same word, but it's a different meaning here. It's, we have our own karma that has given us opportunities in life that maybe others haven't got, and similarly, we may not have opportunities that others have. And so what do we do in those instances? Really, it's just sort of, in my mind, it's a teaching of gratitude. The karma yoga, I feel like if you really want to practice the karma yoga path, it would be one of deep gratitude. And ultimately, why would just a pure karmic yoga path lead you to enlightenment, which the Gita says it would? Why would just be being selfless and not putting yourself first lead you to enlightenment? Well, and it's simply because, as we mentioned earlier, you are giving up your own desires. And the Gita says it's desires that really lead you to your misery. So it sort of leads you away from knowing of beginning of the battle. When we talked a bit about this last week, it's really a metaphor of the battle that's always going on, and who is leading the opposing army to Arjuna is Duryodhana, and he is material desire. So material desire is really, really sort of the one thing that has a grip on us that leads us away from just finding out our yoga, our union, of reaching that place of ourselves. So selfless service is a way of just breaking those desires. And it's not about being dishonest, it's about recognizing those desires, but just gradually working through them, and then maybe cultivating the desire to awaken, and then ultimately letting that go. So that's one reason why selfless service leads to enlightenment. And it also puts us in this place of recognizing that action does not require a doer. Now, we often feel like we're doing. But as we see in the case of Krishna, Krishna is acting in many, many ways, very elaborate ways. He has like a very, very interesting life if you read about the life of Krishna. But he's just being guided. He's just sort of empty, and the Dharma is moving him. So in that case, he really is like the witness. So that's another sort of, I want to say benefit, but I'm not sure that's the right word, of karma yoga, that it allows us to practice sitting back and being the witness, letting ourselves be moved. There's a really rich path, the path of karma yoga. And it also means your whole life is yoga, you know. So your work is yoga. And it's, you have to be creative with it. You know, if you work in a job where you feel you're not helping the world at all, your work is still karma. You can still have karma yoga, and your karma yoga will be service to your boss, service to your colleagues, service to your family, because you're working and putting food on the table, remembering how grateful you are to even just have a job. So often we think there are things in our pathway that we could not lead an entire life of yoga, but it's not true. We really could. Everything we do as the tantrics say, every single thing, every thought, every action is an opportunity to wake up. And the way to wake up is to sacrifice it. And when we say sacrifice, we mean let go of what's valued to us, ourselves, for something more worthy and more valuable, and that is all, the all. So with that, we end this evening's talk on karma yoga. So yeah, it's I think it's my favorite path. There are many important paths. Bhakti yoga, I'm excited to talk about. And maybe we'll do that next week. I haven't quite decided whether we'll do wisdom or devotion. We'll see how the moon is, where the moon is landing. So thank you for being here and seeing. I just thought we'd end just with a moment of silence, where we begin just to become aware of our senses. As I mentioned before, our senses tend to lead us down that path of desire. So I thought we could just settle where we are, take a couple of breaths and become aware of just about the sensations we feel. And just noticing that pull away, whether it's thoughts, whether it's smelling our dinner cooking or feeling the breeze on us and feeling like we want to close a window or open a window. So just becoming real, hearing a neighbor. And then seeing if we can just let all of that go and just rest inside in peace. And then we'll just take a deep inhale together. And exhale it all out. And thank you very much. And namaste to you all. I hope you have a beautiful, blessed week. Thank you. Over to you then.